He's not a, yeah, he's not as well, he's a fifth year.
I'm
so.
A fifth year.
So I was like,
I don't know, sorry.
No, you're good. You're good.
Hey guys, this is DJ DeMorgans.
This is DJ Geist.
And we have a guest with us tonight.
A special guest.
His name is
Harvey?
Harvey Letterman.
Oh. Yeah, Harvey Letterman. I've been saying Lederman the
entire
time.
That's okay. You're allowed to say whatever.
Do you want a DJ name, Harvey?
No.
Okay.
Thanks. This is Harvey Lederman. What's up, guys? This is Philosophy We Think, and you're listening to KBRX 91.7, HD1, and HD2. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Harvey's paper, but first off, we're going to let him introduce himself, give a little bit of his background and what got him into philosophy. For those of you that don't know, Harvey is a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas.
You ever listen to watch college basketball, Harvey?
Sometimes.
You know Dick Vitale, the big man on campus? You're big man on campus.
I started out when I was a student. I was a student of classics and literature. I majored in. I was an undergrad at Princeton. And then I went on to do some graduate work in classics. Then I did PhD in philosophy at Oxford. Mm-hmm. And since then, I taught at NYU, then Pittsburgh, and then Princeton. And I just came to UT in January, and I'm very happy to be here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, we're very happy to have you.
Yes. Especially Peyton, because now there's professors that do Eastern philosophy.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah. I'm slowly working my way up to have the confidence to ask you to be a second reader on my thesis.
There you go. We'll this radio show is part of
it. Dude, he just dropped it on the show. That's iconic.
No, that's good. Okay, so you had mentioned before the show, so the specific paper that we read for tonight was The Introspective Model of Genuine Knowledge in Wang Yangming by yours truly.
Mm-hmm.
And not yours truly, me. Yours truly, Harvey. But you had mentioned that you wanted to talk a little bit about the historical context around the
Ming Dynasty.
Was it the Song Dynasty or
the Ming Dynasty?
Okay, the Ming Dynasty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we got into the paper and
So maybe I'll just say a little bit about how I got interested in Wang Yangming talk about the Ming Dynasty. So I mentioned already that I started out as a classics student, and I was primarily interested in literature. And while I was an undergrad, I was a little bit, maybe embarrassingly, pretty inspired by Ezra Pound, who was maybe a mediocre student of Chinese poetry, but had a lot of excitement about it. And I was inspired by Pound to learn Chinese on the idea that this would be a really helpful way to study Greek poetry, that there would be this sort of interesting connection between Greek poetry and Chinese poetry. So I studied a lot of classical Chinese when I was an undergrad and a bit in grad school. And then as I got into grad school, I got more and more interested in the history of philosophy. So I was really coming to this from a literature student. I was saying to you guys before the show started that I was interested in critical theory was sort of my first exposure to philosophy, and I was exposed to that through my literature classes. And then when I got to grad school, actually, for the first time, I read any Aristotle. It's sort of an embarrassing thing that it wasn't until I was a grad student. And it was like a revelation. I was so excited about philosophy, and I realized that this was a thing that, you know, where had it been all my life, sort of. As I started to get more interested in Greek philosophy, I got interested in thinking about Chinese philosophy. You know, I had previously had this idea of doing comparative literature, and then it occurred to me to sort of do this comparative philosophy. But, you know, as you guys know, because you're philosophy students, I was reading Aristotle, and, like, Aristotle has a particular kind of style, lack of style, some people might say, for doing philosophy. And I was pretty struck by not finding somebody who's sort of doing philosophy in the way that I felt Aristotle was doing it in the canonical authors that I was exposed to in Chinese philosophy in the classical period. And I was trying to read as broadly as I could in the tradition, and this sort of led me to get more interested in a later period in Chinese philosophy where there are much more extended works that are much more clearly involved in trying to do some sort of systematic theorizing about the nature of reality or something like that, right. Which was the part of Aristotle that I was most excited about at the time. So I got more and more interested in these later Confucians, sometimes called Neo-Confucians in English. And I was particularly drawn to this guy, Wang Yangming, who we're going to talk about tonight. And I hope everybody else will agree he's super charismatic historical figure, and also super charismatic writer. So I just was drawn to him and got really interested in it, even though the Greek philosophers I was working on lived, 2,000 years before.
Before, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, this was a question that I think I had for later.
Yeah.
But me and Colin were talking, me and DJ Geist were talking a lot about... how, sorry.
It doesn't matter at this point.
We were talking about how there's this sort of interesting relation that we see between Jung's philosophy, particularly in this work, and Aristotle and Socrates. Would he have read those, or would he have, what's the relation there?
Yeah, let's answer that question one second, but I want to just say a little bit about Wang's life for a bit of context. So I want to just say, Wang Yangming lived from 1472 to 1529. Mm-hmm. So if you just think about where that is in the history of the world sort of context, Columbus was 1492, school.
Yeah. Yep.
So, that was the middle of Wang Yangming's life. So this is a period where Europeans were exploring the planet in a way that was very exciting at the time in Europe. And so you sort of have a sense of what was going on.
Yeah.
Towards the end of Wang's life, we know he's actually associated with some of the early mentions in the Chinese sources of the use by the Chinese of cannons that we know that they got from the Portuguese.
Oh.
So we know that, there were interactions with the Portuguese, sort of famous one around 1516. So sort of not the end of his life, but, he was already in the middle to late stages of his career at that point. What I believe is that he probably would not have had access to, I think this is fairly established, he wouldn't have had access to translated texts the kind that you're talking about. Maybe a century later, some people did have access to those things, and there was, more possibility of that. But even after things were translated, first of all, Aristotle was not the first thing that was translated.
Yeah.
But second of all, there was a kind of resistance, as we also had in Europe, to reading the, it wasn't that, they were translated and everybody read them. I think it's in some sense like logically possible that he could have known these ideas, but probably not. So, maybe let's just back up and talk a little bit about the history. So I said before that Wang was born in 1472 and he died in 1529. This was the middle of the Ming Dynasty. Mm-hmm. So the Ming Dynasty started in 1368 and ended in 1644. So just for a bit of context, that's about three centuries. So 1368, again, if you think in Europe, that's before the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking like Middle Ages, monasteries, thing. It's even really before the start of the kind of like proto-Renaissance in Italy. So it's really like, high Middle Ages period. And 1644 is after the death of Shakespeare. It's actually 2 years after the birth of Newton. So it's an incredibly transformative period in European history, this period.
Mm-hmm.
And it also was in Chinese history, too. It's a long time, three centuries. The Ming Dynasty was founded after the fall of the Mongol Dynasty. So the Mongol Dynasty was, the descendants of Genghis Khan, who ruled in China. And that ended, as I said, in 1368. And it ended with the rise of the Manchu Qing Dynasty, which was the sort of last imperial dynasty of China that lasted until 1905. So it's this kind of, It's a it's a late, people describe it as a period of late imperial history.
Yeah.
The dynasty was ruled by an emperor, as you know, but it was also ruled by a civil service that was primarily populated, or let's say to a large extent populated, through the civil service examinations, which are going to play an important role later.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. This was.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. You're good.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Yang was a part of this civil service in his early and later career, but there was something that happened in the middle there.
In the middle.
and this was very integral to his philosophy, as I recall. There was some sort of revelation or something that he had when he was exiled or
totally
put away. If you want to talk to that.
Yeah, totally. So I'll just say his last name is Wang.
Wang.
Yeah. But so Wang was born into a family that his dad was also an official and had also done very well on the civil service examinations. There were three rounds of examinations that you had to sit in order to sort of progress to the highest level. And Wang passed them, I believe, in 1499, maybe 1498, I can't recall exactly. So when he was about 26 or 27. And he did very well, and he was given a good official post, and he served in these official posts. I guess we should say a little bit about. So the people in power in the Imperial Ming state were not just the emperor and these officials, but there were also very powerful eunuchs. And the eunuchs were a special political class because they were allowed to have personal access to the emperor. And so it's a sort of common story of Ming elite life that an official would fall out of favor with a eunuch, and there would be a sort of power battle between the eunuch and the official. Partly this was because, I guess, emperors were a little bit not taking part always in the daily running of the empire, but also it was because the eunuchs could sort of circumvent what was going on with the emperor because they were go-betweens. Also, the civil servants could do the same. But these were the kind of battles that happened. So Wang fell out of favor with the very powerful eunuch, and he was, due to this, I mean, there's more to the story than this, but due to this, he was publicly lashed, and it was a punishment that for some people could be fatal. I mean, it was really horrible. And then he was essentially banished, although it wasn't really banishment. It was just being sent to a more remote part of the empire where he served.
Interesting. Yeah. And if I recall, this eunuch himself was illegitimate, and then was, by the time Wang had returned, he himself had been executed.
Right, so that was again a common story, was that the eunuchs would sort of be running, you know, they would be exerting too much power, and then eventually they would be found out or exposed when they got sort of, you know, too powerful, so there was this kind of constant back and forth. I mean, I'm hamming it up a little bit, but that was that's a sort of story that you read about.
That's a lot of political tension right there.
A lot of intrigue.
Interesting. So on the sort of other spectrum, and working our way towards the paper of historical context, there was this character, and if am I gonna say it right, is it Zhu Xi?
Zhu Xi.
I told you the Google Translate was wrong.
I did my best.
That doesn't sound right.
There's this important. Was he a philosopher, or was he?
So that's great. So we've talked a little bit about imperial history. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about, okay, where does the Ming Dynasty sort of fit in Chinese imperial history? But now we should talk a little bit about an intellectual context, and then we can come back to this pivotal moment that you described when Wang was in exile or whatever this sort of. So let's go back 300 years, 400 years earlier. So in the 10th century, let's say, the 10th and 11th century, there was a revival of Confucianism, or it's often described as a revival of Confucianism, a sort of backward-looking attempt to find a sort of renewed meaning in classical Confucian texts. Mm-hmm. And it's a very sort of false potted narrative, I would say, but maybe a helpful way to be introduced to this story is to think of it as there was a kind of Buddhism was a system of thought that came into China from the outside. And there was a challenge that Buddhism brought to Confucianism, which is that Confucianism had been an ethical slash political system. Again, this is this sort of potted narrative that I don't love, but I think it's helpful to think of it, you know, as the story. And there was this challenge to Confucianism to offer like a systematic vision of the universe or something. And in response to that, but also in response to sort of local political pressure, over a medium length period of time, there was a lot of deep thinking about looking to aspects of the Confucian tradition that maybe hadn't been as central before, in a way, you know, as a way of finding this more sort of systematic vision for how people fit into the universe and what it all means, something like that. And so there were a number of important thinkers who were emerged in especially the 11th century, I would say. The thought that they sort of put together was systematized and integrated by this thinker, Zhu Xi, who lived from 1130 to 1200. And Zhu Xi also innovated in his own right, but he was also doing a lot of putting together and synthesizing, as I said before. Sometimes Zhu Xi, and I think, again, this is like, you know, it's an analogy. What does it really do for us? But it's a helpful way maybe to get started. Sometimes people compare Zhu Xi to Aquinas. He's a figure who produced a ton of written work, a ton of commentary on classic texts. And indeed, that was a way that he exerted influence on the tradition. And sometimes people compare Wang Yangming to Descartes. So, you know, Descartes was reacting against the scholastic tradition, offering a sort of back to basics approach to lots of issues in theoretical philosophy, most obviously. And people think of Wang similarly as reacting to the scholastic tradition that Zhu Xi, you know, that is associated with the name of Zhu Xi, associated with the name of Zhu Xi, and offering a sort of more back to basics approach.
Interesting. Okay. We've got 5 minutes to go till we have to go to break.
I'm talking too much.
No, it's good. It's great. So should we talk about this revelation and this sort of like foundations of Confucianism that ground the paper that you wrote before or after the break?
I think let's wait till after the break. Maybe we can say one more thing about Zhu Xi and we could start at that after the break. Okay. Yeah. So you know, Zhu Xi, as I said, he died in 1200. So that was 270 years before Wang was born. But Zhu Xi became a pivotal figure, I mean, for many reasons, but in part through commentaries that he wrote, as I mentioned, on the classic texts and on these older classic Confucian texts and through his interpretation of them. And most importantly, in the early 14th century, so in the early 1300s, I believe the year was 1312, Zhu Xi's texts were made the basis of the civil service examination, or at least of an important part of the civil service examination. This is a kind of interesting historical story. It was during the Yuan Dynasty, which, as I mentioned, was the Mongol Dynasty. So you might think, wait, why were they so interested? You know, why were they so interested in this classic Confucianism? That's its own sort of political story. But what I want to say is that Wang who himself had to go through this process of the civil service examinations, he would have memorized, literally memorized, large portions of Zhu Xi's writings. Not large portions relative, Zhu Xi wrote an enormous amount, you know, significant by what, you and I couldn't memorize this amount of stuff, you know? So he memorized a lot of the thought of Zhu Xi, and this was, you know, very much the world that, you know, all of his thinking about the Confucian text would have been inflected, and his peers, by the writings of Zhu Xi. Zhu Xi was just a towering figure at that time. So maybe when we come back from the break, we can talk about Zhu Xi's thought and how Wang reacted to it.
Yeah, that's great. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We will be right back here in just a minute after we run some ads, and what you're about to hear is All Night by Bump Love. We'll be right back, guys.
Hey, this is Eve from Palm. You're listening to KVRX Austin. Bye.
Support for KVRX comes from UT Athletics and Texas Football, returning for the Orange-White game on Saturday, April 15th at 1 p.m. at Darrell K. Royal, Texas Memorial Stadium. Pre-game activities are open to all fans and kickoff at 9 a.m. with Texas Football signing autographs, live music, carnival games, rides, food trucks, and more. More information about the game and all Made in Austin events can be found at texassports.com. Hook 'em horns!
We keep campus running, and you can support your favorite student media organizations right now.
If you're wondering
how, why?
Well, you can visit supportstudentvoices.org
to lend us a helping hand. By doing this, you can chip in or donate to your favorite TSM organizations
like KVRX 91.7, The Drag Audio,
Texas Student Television,
The Cactus Yearbook,
and even our campus newspapers, The Texas Travesty and Daily Texan.
Remember, it's supportstudentvoices.org. Stay tuned.
We can keep talking.
We're back, boys.
It's nice to have like a natural transition.
Yeah, we're back. Which is now disrupted.
No worries.
So,
Hey guys, you're listening to Philosophy We Think. This is 91.7.
And this is DJ Geis.
And DJ DeMorgans. and Harvey Lederman.
Yep.
Harvey Letterman. Where do we leave off? Do you want to go ahead?
You want to ask that question off
the
show?
That'd be great.
So, like, I asked a question during the break, and I was like, what, like, direct influence did the Empire have on
Wong's
thought, his philosophical system, since he was part of, like, a political elite class?
Yeah. I think that's a really important question, and I think something that, let's say, I could think a lot more about, but I think maybe also sometimes as philosophers doing the history of this, we don't think about the kind of, you know, these sort of, as it were, covert influences. We like to think, you know, we're just sort of minds floating around there's no, material influence, of course. Then we go buy our coffee. Wong actually, sort of part of the narrative around him was sort of a new class dynamic. There was a lot of controversy among his students because there's one recorded instance where he definitely took illiterate students who were from a different class. So it was customary for teachers to have a kind of like entourage of students, and Wong was interested in working not just with the hyper elite landed people who were going to go on to take these resource intensive civil service examinations that took a decade of study, but also people who were just pursuing being a virtuous person. Mm-hmm. And this is part of a broader, if you were going to tell the sort of pure bottom-up economic story, you would talk about how in the middle of the Ming Dynasty, in this period, there is an emerging or a strengthening, let's say, middle class, a stronger merchant population within China, and Wong's relationship to them is sort of maybe not so individualistic, like he was such an amazing person, but also a part of the broader sort of changing landscape. But I think it was exceptional even in the time. Yeah. And he, as I was saying in the break, there's one student of his, in particular, Wang Gun, who in a conversation that they have that's recorded in some of the recorded conversations is responsible for this sort of what's now a saying that the streets are full of sages, and the idea is that anybody, no matter who you are, you can become a virtuous person. And that was a heterodox view in this sort of philosophical pursuit of virtue. It had previously been the province of people who were able to read classical Chinese for many, many years really pursue this very elite kind of education. That was the only way you could really be a Confucian.
Right.
And Wong had a very different vision.
Yeah, for our listeners, we did a lot of ethics.
We've done a lot of ethics.
Ethics. And contrast to Aristotle, like Aristotle thinks only like well-brought-up people can like have this like virtuous type life.
Yeah, and it seemed innate, and you can speak to this, but it seemed innate in Chu Xi's philosophy that, I think you stated in your paper that reading classical text was moral cultivation for Chu Xi, but as I take it, Wong went a different way.
Yeah.
Trying to push us towards the paper so that
So let's talk about that now. So we sort of left Wong in this exiled moment in after 1506, Wong was at around this time had a kind of remarkable moment of enlightenment where he thought that there was or at least it's recorded that he thought that there was a voice speaking to him in the night. And at this time, he had a revelation for how a lot of the Confucian classic texts fit together. This is against a sort of narrative in his life where earlier in his life, at least we're told, he was really into all the bad things like calligraphy, riding horses, all the sort of playing lacrosse, all of the sort of deluded pastimes of youth, and he spent some time in being very interested in Buddhism, very interested in Taoist alchemy, yeah. And then ultimately he got into, you know, sort of became more serious about Confucianism, and this revelation was really crucial to that. So as a young man, he tells us in a kind of backward-looking autobiography, he tells us that he had an experience where he tried out Zhu Xi's method of moral cultivation and found it to be dissatisfactory. So maybe we should say a little bit about that, and then we can set up getting into his philosophy.
Yeah, so he has this, well, and as I understand it, this is all Confucian philosophy in general. There's this concept of the pattern, and then is it the qi?
The qi.
The qi, okay.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that. So one of the major kind of, I wouldn't say distinctive, but something that becomes characteristic of Neo-Confucianism is this emphasis on li, which is often translated as principle, but often translated as pattern. And this was an idea that was an old concept. It had been around for a long time. But it came to be really central to the thought of the Neo-Confucians who I mentioned before, and also Zhu Xi as the sort of culmination of this. And the way that Zhu Xi understood pattern or principle was that it was somehow inscribed in the world. So it sort of played two roles. Again, this is really quick and rough, but it sort of played two roles. One is of natural law in terms of, like, we would think of the laws of physics or something like that. Yeah. But the other is as the moral law. So it has this sort of double life as explaining the way the physical stuff unfolds, but also explaining what's good and what's the right thing to do and stuff like that. And so Zhu Xi thought, or at least a bastardization of Zhu Xi thought, that you could learn about the moral law by inspecting the natural world around you. So you could learn about li, this pattern principle thing, by learning about, you know, how things fall or whatever it is. And so Wang tried to implement this. He took it very literally. And he and a friend of his tried to find the li in some bamboo. And they stared at it for a number of days, trying to detect the moral law within it. And this became an event which, at the time, Wang just was sort of frustrated maybe with himself, or at least that's one telling of it. But later, he came to think of it as something that sort of showed him that Zhu Xi was on the wrong track. Right. And that if we were going to look for moral cultivation, we had for moral virtue, we had to look not in bamboo.
Yeah.
But ultimately, this was the sort of content of his enlightenment. But we had to look within ourselves.
Yeah. And that's that very Cartesian like relation there, I suppose.
It feels a little bit like that. Right, yeah, right. This sort of do-it-yourself kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the sort of after this enlightenment, Wang proposed a new doctrine, which is now sort of a canonical thing associated with his name, which is called the unity of knowledge and action. And somehow this doctrine was supposed to embody his new conclusion that the way to become a virtuous person didn't have to do with looking at bamboo, but had to do with looking in your own mind, maybe, and that somehow we were self-sufficient, containing the sources of morality within ourselves. And yeah, my paper talks about the unity of knowledge and action.
Right. So importantly, and I don't know if I'm going too quick here, I don't know if I'm skipping steps, but importantly, this unity of knowledge and action, as I take it, is the unity of not of action and genuine knowledge, not just this sort of knowledge, because these are two separate things, and they're, you can sort of pull this distinction apart by, is it Liangzhi?
Liangzhi.
Liangzhi.
Yeah.
Don't no trust worries. Google Translate.
No worries. Guys, don't. No worries. Okay, so Liangzhi sort of pulls out this distinction of genuine knowledge, and or maybe more so wholeheartedness, I guess I should say, is what it makes the contrast. But if you is that where, am I skipping too many steps there, or is that a good place to go?
I think maybe we could just hear, maybe I'll just read one passage, maybe the most famous passage where Wang talks about the unity of knowledge and action.
Yeah.
Partly because, honestly, you know, when you do the history of philosophy, maybe not everybody feels this way, but for me, I feel like what I most want is not for people to listen to me, but for people to listen to Wang Yangming. Yeah, I think he's a really interesting philosopher. And so if anybody out there is listening, you know, it's much more important to me anyway, that someone goes and buys the book of Wang Yangming and reads that than that they read anything I've written. But so I think this is a really beautiful passage. So this is a passage that comes to us in a collection of recorded sayings between Wang's favorite student and Wang, and it's recorded by this favorite student. And so the favorite student has been up all night listening to a radio show. No, he's been up all night. he's been up all night thinking about the unity of knowledge and action. And he says, you know, I'm really struggling with it. Like, I wanna believe it, but I don't know how to think about it. And Wang says, well, why don't you give me an example that's bothering you? And this student, whose name is Xu Ai, he says, well, today, I'm reading a translation, obviously.
Right.
He says, today, everybody knows that you should be filial to your parents and respectful to your older brothers. So those are important values in this tradition. But they're unable to be filial and unable to be respectful. So he says, in this case, knowledge and action are clearly two different things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you guys, maybe you talked about this when you talked about Aristotle, this is like an example of akrasia or weak will.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's very similar to that.
Yeah,
we
were talking about the continent versus the virtuous man and this idea of feeling, well, I guess maybe, but yeah, still feeling the like pulls towards doing the non-virtuous action and this weakness of will or being able to choose the wrong action. But yeah.
But I think it's a very powerful example. I mean, I don't really know. I hope I'm a filial son, but I'm not sure if I am. But I think, and I'm fortunate not to have any older brothers that I have to be respectful to. But I do correct my younger brothers when they fail to be respectful. But I think it's a powerful kind of example that you know, we are constantly know what we ought to be doing and failing to do it. I mean, it's like, and also we're very good at seeing that in other people, even if we aren't so good at seeing it in ourselves, right? So I think it's a very powerful example. And obviously it strikes us as a problem for the doctrine. If you want to say that knowledge and action are unified, how could it be that I know what to do and yet fail to act on it? I mean, and I think the example also helps us to understand what what content Xu Ai, this student, thought the doctrine had. And Wang replies, and this is, you know, an uber famous passage in the Chinese tradition. You know, as I was saying, this is a thinker who is, you know, of the stature of Descartes in the tradition, and yet we barely know his name. You know, it's a quite incredible fact. Anyway, Wang replies, and this is, you know, uber famous discussion. He says, in this case, knowledge and action have already been separated by selfish desires. And they're no longer knowledge and action in their original substance. This is a bad translation, but it's a common one. There have never been people who know but do not act. If you know but don't act, you simply don't yet know.
Right.
And this is a part where this is the sort of powerful image. He says, the great learning points to genuine knowledge and action for people to see. Mm. It says they are like loving lovely colors and hating hateful odors.
Yep.
Seeing a lovely color belongs to knowledge, while loving a lovely color belongs to action. But once someone sees a lovely color, he already loves it. It's not that he sees it first and afterwards makes up his mind to love it. Smelling a hateful odor belongs to knowledge, while hating a hateful odor belongs to action. But once someone smells a hateful odor, he already hates it. It's not that he smells it first and afterwards makes up his mind to hate it. So that's a pretty spectacular kind of example. The idea that your knowledge of what the virtuous thing to do is supposed to be like the compulsion that you have, the love that you feel towards a beautiful thing.
Right.
And this translation of color, this is a sort of maybe a mistranslation. Maybe it should just be a lovely sight. It doesn't have to be a lovely color.
Is this similar to like Hume stuff on sentiments? Or
tell me what you're thinking of.
Like how, like, if something's like, if there's like a
instantly, immediately,
immediately, yeah, like if something's pleasurable to me, then it's virtuous, and if something's like unpleasurable to me, then it's like a vice. Like there's this like notion, this instant sentiment. Like if it makes me feel good, then it's just it's virtuous. Like is that like a similar thought that's
Well, it's not true in every case that if it makes you feel good, it's virtuous.
Right, right, right. Because there's also usefulness that he would contrast. I think what DJ Geis is trying to get at is this idea of the sort of like immediate agreeableness.
Yeah.
It seems as the in the paper you phrase it as Longju knows.
It
simply knows. There is no sort of digging deeper to the goodness. And without skipping too far ahead, I did want to ask, so this innate sense knows, but also it collects it acquires knowledge, and this is in contrast with, I believe, is it Mencius?
Yeah.
Who says that it's innate. And there was a contrast made there in the paper that I'm not sure I quite fully understood, but I don't know if that's skipping too far.
Let's come to that. So we have this discussion of the unity of knowledge and action, which is around the year 1510, we think. And then there's a really important later development in at least the way that Wang articulates his thought. So we've already seen that he places this great emphasis on our kind of ability to respond immediately to virtuous things. But he's aware that people are not always virtuous, right? Okay. So he obviously knows that people are bad. For example, some eunuchs, you know, whip him for no reason. Yeah. I mean, he's sensitive to that. And what he says is going on with those people is they do have a good inner faculty, but it's been covered over by selfish desire. Self-centered desires. Maybe selfish is a bad translation. That's been something that's been much discussed in the scholarship. But so Wang has this picture already in 1510, but he doesn't have a very detailed, or at least arguably, he doesn't yet have a very detailed picture of the psychology that underlies this whole kind of system. So he kind of knows that he wants to say, but... his discussions of in this earlier period don't kind of document which part of your mind is doing what or whatever.
Right.
And in 1521, at least this is what we're told, and it's reflected in the documents, Wang starts to associate this inner ability to know what to do in the cases, this innate capacity to respond virtuously to what's around you. He comes to associate this with a concept that he's taken from Mencius, or at least an expression that he's taken from Mencius, which is this thing that I leave untranslated in my paper, which is Liangzhi. And that's actually two characters. The first one means good, basically, and the second one means knowledge. So some translators translate it as good knowledge. Some translators translate it as innate knowledge. As some translators prefer something like good knowing. They don't like the word, the noun knowledge. Anyway, it's something in that family of things. And I think it's helpful to think about this expression by analogy to the English word conscience, to our notion of conscience. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that we sometimes think like, oh yeah, my conscience told me to do something, you know? And it's almost like this force that is within you but acts as though it's from outside of you. That's something that I think has a lot of resonance with what Wang is talking about when he talks about Liangzhi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's you gave the example of a thief, or he gave the example of a thief, I think, who steals and still feels bad about it and presents himself as though he didn't do it around some
other people,
person of stature. And so in some sense, he knows that what he did is bad. So there is this sort of conscience in there that's telling him, no, you shouldn't have done that. But in the same sense, he's able to account Wang for poor actions
A way that I like to think about it is, so I think, you know, if you think about the conscience in English, like the way we talk about the conscience, like, can you think of a time when you really felt like your conscience, or something that your conscience really speaks to you about? You don't have to tell the audience. You can think about it,
right?
So can you tell me some like aspects of the way of like these of that situation? I mean, you don't have to say details, but
I mean, it's this, I think it's what you would classically say is like the voice in my head.
Yeah.
This sort of like voice in my head that's like, don't do that, don't do that. And then you do it anyways.
I don't know about you, but it seems to me like the cases where it's most relevant are ones that are of great moral import. So they're big decisions, or they're ones that have really deep consequences for other people. So like my conscience doesn't really speak to me about like, you know, whether to, I don't know, put the fork on the left or something like that. It doesn't talk to me about small actions. They've got to be ones that seem to have really serious moral consequences.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I was trying to think what... I'm trying to think of an example, but I can't think of none off the top of my head.
But I think... Anyway, so I think Wong really... If you push my idea that this is connected, and it's not just mine, I mean, you know, many people have had this thought, and indeed the word that Wong uses for Liangzhi is closely connected to the modern Chinese word for conscience. So this is sort of even more of an obvious connection to make if we were speaking Chinese right now. But I think one way to think about what's going on here is that the phenomenology that of the conscience, you know, this sort of thing where it speaks to you in the most weighty of situations, is something that Wong thought was also present in all actions that you took. It's just that your selfish desires had kind of are like white noise covering over the noise of the voice of your conscience. So if you were really in tune with your Liangzhi, with this underlying moral force within you, moral force is the wrong word, but you know, some kind of this innate knowledge, this source of moral sentiment, if you were really in tune with it, then you would be guided to act, you know, smoothly and appropriately in every single situation that you were presented with, even when you were on a late night radio show.
right. Yeah, that's good. So getting towards
you wrote these incredibly detailed notes. I feel like I blew by them, but I'll have to give we'll have to meet have a separate meeting to talk about them.
Right. Yeah. No, but so this concept of I keep forgetting how to say it. Liangzhi.
You can just say conscience.
I'll use that for the rest.
That's actually when I give talks about this, I'm like, I know you're going to be afraid to ask questions.
Right. So this concept of conscience is important in the concept or in the idea of genuine knowledge, but it doesn't fully explain the idea of genuine knowledge. So there's this way of having ethically relevant knowledge that or ethically relevant knowledge that doesn't involve genuine knowledge, and genuine knowledge is this sort of, as you describe it, elevated form of knowledge.
Right.
And relating it to the SCP article that I read.
Yeah.
I believe would this be the sort of like clearing of the chi? Is that what this sort of genuine knowledge would be? This clearing of I think you say doxastic conflict. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know our listeners are like, what the heck does doxastic mean?
We can get into it.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. So we've already seen that in the unity of knowledge and action. I mean, I read this passage where he says that no one has ever known but failed to act. Mm. But then I also told you that everybody has this conscience-like thing, Liangzhi. So you might be thinking, wait a second, how could it be that everyone has knowledge, but sometimes people are bad? Clearly the answer to this puzzle must be that there's knowledge in two different senses, right? There's the knowledge that you always have, this good knowing, this Liangzhi, this innate knowledge. And then there's some other thing that you can have. And Wong sometimes uses the expression genuine knowledge for this, what I call an elevated state of knowledge, the thing that is the topic of the unity of knowledge and action, the thing that's unified with action. And then the question of my paper, and I think a good question, obviously, because I wrote a paper about it, is what's the gap between the thing that everybody always has and the elevated thing that suffices for virtuous action? I mean, he's saying a really strong thing about this form of knowledge, that if you ever have that knowledge, you're guaranteed to act virtuously. And so what can be the connection between those two things?
Yeah. We got 3 minutes left. So, how do we want to wrap up here? I know we really didn't get to as much as we wanted to. How can
I think
we
it's great. If people heard about Wang Yongming, I'm so happy. Great. Yeah. So it's that's good. Great. People, yeah. I think, so maybe I'll say just sort of one other thing about an aspect of Wang's thought that we could close the loop with. So I mentioned already the unity of knowledge and action. Mm-hmm. But another really important doctrine of Wang Yongming's, and something that he came up with also pretty early, and we also mentioned Liangzhi, this conscience-like thing, which was another important doctrine. But another important doctrine of his is the idea that mind is principle, or sometimes people say heart mind is principle. Principle is this thing that we were talking about before, pattern, li, this key doctrine of Juxi's. And so another shift that he tried to make in this sort of set of concepts was the idea that whatever role this pattern principle was playing for Juxi, the thing that was supposedly in the bamboo, that was instead in your mind. And, you know, we don't have time to do justice to this here, but the idea roughly was that this conscience-like thing that you have within you, that's where the moral law is flowing from, rather than the world around you. So I think those are probably Wang's three most famous doctrines, so we've at least gotten them out here tonight, and I hope people will maybe go read a bit of Wang Yongming.
Hopefully
there's
I know I will I'll read further.
Great.
Additionally, if you guys have any questions or you're interested in this, you can always DM us on Instagram at philosophywethink, and we'll be happy to send you papers over or
handle them questions.
Yeah, I'll handle those questions. We'll be happy to send you papers or books or just answer questions as much as we can, or ask Harvey the question and then answer the question for you. But we appreciate you guys tuning in very much tonight.
We always like to give different philosophy on our show, you know, give a broad scope of philosophy. I think we did good tonight.
Yeah, I think we...
Thank you guys so much for having me on the show.
Yes,
it's really been a pleasure. It's
really
been fantastic.
And we will see you guys next week for our very last week on KVRX.
Yeah, who are we going to get on?
Yeah, I don't know.
We had Emily. We had...
Harvey. Can't top Harvey.
But we'll
be on for our final week on KVRX last week, and then next week, and then we'll be moving over strictly to Spotify. We appreciate you guys, and y'all stay tuned in for DJ Yerba Mulita.